Good morning, everyone. Hope all you all can hear me. Glad to see so many people here today when we're going to talk about the black magic of SharePoint architecture. It's going to be full day of SharePoint goodness here today. We've got a lot of interesting sessions going on. And I thought I'd wake you up here. And it's great to see so many people interested in this. My name is Victor Wilén. I'm from Sweden. I work for a consultant company there. I have a couple of certifications. For the whole day, it's going to be a SharePoint certified master on the stage all the time. So it's going to be a really deep level today. So stay awake, drink a lot of coffee. When I'm not working with SharePoint, which is basically all my time, I work a lot with our house and rebuilding it, and still thinking of SharePoint. I've written two books, of which the last one is coming out this November. But this development books. I've gone from the developer to an architecture in SharePoint or IT Pro kind of guy, so I'm kind of versatile there. But the development stuff has learned me a lot about on how to design solutions, and both the actual development of the solutions and also how to implement it to scale out and scale up, etc. And we're going to talk a lot about that. And I'm not always the kind of guy that does everything by the book, because doing it by the book does not work in the real world. Unfortunately. And also, what's in the book is always the extreme examples, not the ordinary customer that 99% of us are targeting. How many of you here are IT pros or infrastructure guys or girls? How many are developers? That's good, some fellows there. So, today we're going to talk about some of the architectural changes in SharePoint 2013. That we, as an architecture, or when we design SharePoint solutions, must be aware of and or can take advantage of. We're going to talk about different topology considerations. How many servers do I need? Where do I put this and that? Where do I put the query server? Where do I put the MMS, etc.? I'm not going to give you the right way to do it. I'm going to give you my way of doing it. What I've done with my customers and how it actually works. Then we're going to talk about single web application hostname site collections. How many have heard of hostname site collections? Well, not that many. How many actually knows what a hostname site collection is? That's a few of you. We're going to talk about that, but because I think that's really important. That's one of the most important changes, in my opinion, and that also not many people are aware of, but it makes it so much easier to do really great stuff with SharePoint using this. And it's also the way Office 365 does it, which means that it's properly tested. Finally, we're going to take a look at two samples from my recent projects, how I built out those farms. And finally, some stuff you shouldn't do, but a lot of people do anyway. Does that sound good? I heard a little yes there. So let's start with the new stuff and the changes in SharePoint 2013 compared to previous versions. Oh, first of all, why do we need this? I talked about it a little bit earlier, but the term best practices, it's very generic. And one best practice might not be applicable to another, to one customer and another, etc. Each and every customer has their own best practice. It's really important to know. So just because you read something on TechNet, it's not always the best practice. Not for your customer, not for their budget, nor for their operations teams. So don't believe everything you read, except in this deck. And also, TechNet is very technical focused. It doesn't often take into account the actual client you're working with, their operations team, their management team, their budget, etc. Or your team that's going to build the solution, your development team, etc. So there's other requirements you have to weigh in when designing a SharePoint solution. And unfortunately, some architects or some designers of SharePoint solutions, they consume too much Kool-Aid. They try to use all the new cool features just because they can. Or try to build out the 25 server farm for 50 users just because they can. And why? So in the end, the customer is going to look, yeah, it works, but how much does it cost? Correct me if I'm wrong. How many have implemented farms in here with 20 or more servers? Yeah, Neil and a couple of others. It worked for Office 365. So there's a couple of thousand servers there. So it's not that many. Is 5 more appropriate for your average customers, or 7, or 1? Shout. 4, I heard, yeah. About 3, 5, 7, 8, or the more ordinary customer, at least I think here in New Zealand and in Sweden and the vast majority of Europe, or perhaps in the US they go up a bit higher. And of course, that's where the technical documentation comes from, the large customers in the US. So, what's new for SharePoint Architect? First of all, it's basically the same infrastructure as in 2010. We have the service application framework, which is a really good way, and I'm glad they didn't change it this time. I'm glad we got rid of the shared service provider in 2007, but this new service application framework introduced in 2010 is much more agile and scalable, and more flexible. But they also introduced a couple of new service applications, distributed cache, for instance, or request management, access services. We're going to take a deeper look at a few of them. But some things are no longer service applications or services within SharePoint. For instance, Office Web Apps is a separate product. Workflow Manager, workflow can work exactly the same it did in 2010, but also we can also take advantage of the Workflow Manager as a separate disconnected workload from SharePoint. And this has to be taken into consideration when designing a farm. And especially Workflow Manager, Wayne Unton here is an expert on it, and we have different opinions on how to place it. But that's how a real-world architecture and discussion is. You have to weigh in pros and cons and cost and skills. And of course, the app model, it changes a lot of things as well, especially for developers. So let's take a look at some of these new service applications. First of all, the distributed cache. It's an implementation specifically made for SharePoint. It's using the Azure App Fabric Cache Service, but modified to suit SharePoint better, which is used for storing cached search queries and results, storing the security token, etc. It gives a lot of benefits, and it's really important, especially if you're using SharePoint Social. You should not use it in your own custom projects. Actually, it's not supported. You can use App Fabric Caching Service, but then you have to set up a separate cache cluster somewhere out of SharePoint to use. But this is a really important thing. I've read on some blogs people having problem with it. They turn it off and gain a little bit better performance in their test environments. But if you turn it off, you lose a lot of functionality in SharePoint. This is a really important thing to weigh in. And it also affects your topology and design very much because it consumes a lot of RAM, has some restraints, etc. I'll show you later how I used it in my current projects. Request management is one of these Kool-Aid features that a lot of people turn on just because they can and have no idea what they're doing. It's actually a really, really good feature if you know what you're doing and you have demand for it. It's basically a built-in software load balancer within SharePoint. So when a request comes in, SharePoint can either through the rules you set up or by using a health-based routing. Route one request from one server to a more healthy server or a dedicated server and process the request there and send it back. It's a really good feature, but should be used with caution. The third one here is App Management Service, very lightweight service. But it's foundation for the new app model. And it requires subscription service, etc. If you saw Mark Rhodes' session yesterday, you all know about this. Yeah. This is some small new service applications. Machine translation service. Automatic translation of text, Word documents, an important one. It has a couple of things you need to think about. This one reaches out on the internet, sends your corporate information out to the Bing translation services and send it translated back. So it might sound good. My customer, they cannot send their corporate information outside of the network, so they can't use this one. So that are some things you need to think about. Work management service, also quite lightweight one, aggregates information from project server, from Exchange, if you have Exchange 2013, up to your personal site. You get all these tasks in a nice timeline, as Debbie showed you in her session yesterday. This is an interesting one, access services. How many of you has used access services in 2010? A few of you. How many have used access? The client. Oh, nobody wants to put up the hand there, but everybody has used it. So, but Access Services 2013 is totally rebuilt. Actually, you can use both Access Services 2010 and 2013 in SharePoint 2013. But Access Services 2013 is built upon contained databases in SQL Server 2012, which means for every single Access Services 2013 instance you're putting up, a new database is automatically created in SQL Server, which means if you have 1,000 instances of Access Services 2013, you will have 1,000 instances of a new database in SQL Server. And your SQL admins, they don't like this that much. So watch out for that one. Or if you're going to use it, make sure you have a good plan for it. So some of the services are re-architected, and some of them are really re-architected, especially search. Search is basically rewritten from scratch, taking the best things from SharePoint Search and from Fast Search combined into a completely new search engine. I'm not going to talk too much about it right now. Neil is going to take you on a long journey later. Hope you don't fall asleep on that session. You will not. It's so much information, but it's one of my favorite features. And it's basically used for everything. We built a couple of public.com sites, and they're all based on search. You saw that in the WCM session yesterday as well. How you use the catalogs and leverage search to publish information. Office web apps, previously service application in SharePoint, now a separate server product. That's really important to know. Workflow, I mentioned it earlier. To get the new workflow in SharePoint 2013, you need to set up a separate workflow manager farm, which has its own restrictions and constraints. So that was some of the new service applications, services, and changes. That's really important to know when building out the new SharePoint farm. If we take a look what has changed more, claims-based authentication. We hated it in 2010 because nothing did work with claims-based authentication, basically. Now it's the default in 2013, which means they have changed it. Classic mode, which we used in 2010, everything worked, and nothing worked with claims in 2010. Now it's the opposite. It's claims, everything works, with classic, not everything works. So, and this, for a new farm, is not that big deal, but it's a big deal if you're doing an upgrade, because then you most likely have to convert from classic to claims. And if everything is in order, it's going to work, but if you have some custom solutions built that using the username or that kind of things, you might have to rebuild your solution. So watch out for that one, especially when upgrading. And for this to work as well, as I mentioned, the distributed cache earlier, it's caching the security token to get really good performance out of SharePoint 2013 with claims-based authentication. You must have a working distributed cache. Here's a nice term, OAuth. OAuth is as an admin, IT pro, we have to know what it is and must know the implications of it. OAuth is the authorization framework used for instance, apps, workflow, etc., to authorize applications to talk to SharePoint, etc. So it's a security mechanism. And the interesting things here are that security data are sent over the wire. So we should basically use SSL to protect that data. I'm coming back to that later. We have a variant of OAuth that's called server-to-server authentication. It's not OAuth, it's based on the OAuth protocol, but it's used for instance, apps and workflow. OAuth, you basically have three parties. You have a trusted party on the side that actually makes sure that the sender and receiver are who they are. In server-to-server authentication, you basically have a certificate that's exchanged instead. You don't have that third party. So now we've seen a couple of new things that we need to think of when building out the farm. And we're going to go through a couple of other things to prepare for the actual prepare for the actual implementation. And most architects base their design and considerations, etc., on their experience. I do, based on my previous stuff, what I've done. I take a look at what others have done. That's why I think it's important you're here and discuss this with each other. You read on the internet, you read on blogs, etc. And actually on TechNet, there are a couple of good, decent examples that Microsoft had tested out, but they are more large, really large farms they tested it on. And you can find diagrams such as this one. It has 20, 30 servers or something. You think that might be a good start? Or this one, it's even more servers, combination of physical and virtual machines. But that's not how it works in the real world. You cannot just take this one and put in the knees of a customer. They're going to slap you in the face, say it's too expensive. And of course, most likely they don't even have that operations team that can manage that kind of solution. And you don't want to be stuck there all your life fiddling with 30 servers and patching and upgrading, etc. So we have to get back and think about the reality. What do we actually need? Well, of course, there are cases where you need this. If you have terabytes of data or that's going to be searched, etc., then, yeah, you might need it. I don't say it's wrong, but it's not the average installation. So it's all about compromises here. So, first of all, we need to think of, we're building a SharePoint 2013 farm. What are our customers going to use it for? Is it a collaborative intranet? Is it a public-facing.com site? Is it a lot of workflows? Do you search a lot? How much content do we have? Is it 1 million documents, 10 million documents, or 100 million documents? It's really important to paint that out first and see what the customer... If you ask a customer what you're going to use it for, are you going to use it as an intranet, as a social enterprise feature, etc., they're going to say yes to everything. Of course, they want everything, but you have to give them the pros and cons of it, or most likely the cons of having everything at once. I recommend starting at a smaller scale, focus on what's important. Then SharePoint is a good product. It's easy to scale out, just money. So think of this first. What are you actually building here? And don't enable all the features. You don't need that. So what's their budget? You have to make the customer aware of this when you start out the project. Give them a rough estimate. If you're going to use all these features and you have 10,000 users, for instance, this is roughly what's going to cost, just hardware, just in operations, maintenance. Give that up front to them early so you have that with you in the discussion. You're not, after you've done a pre-study of 3 months and say, this is how it's going to cost. I always bring this up really early in the discussion with the customer, so we can focus on the right things, so we don't have to go back and do a 3-month pre-study again. This is another important thing that many people forget. As a consultant, as I am, I go in and do my job, and then I get out of there. But then someone has to take care of this farm, or farms. And how skilled are they? Do they need training, etc.? You have to factor in that as well. For instance, there are patches every other month for SharePoint. Of course, you shouldn't install them, but you have to test them and see if it works, etc. And you have to have that planning. And patching a SharePoint farm isn't for the faint-hearted. So you really need trained operations personnel to get the SharePoint farm running smoothly. And what's the resources? Do they have a big virtualization rig? Do they use cloud services or whatever? Do they need new investments? I had one customer, they had to buy a whole new set of virtualization rig just to host the SharePoint farm. And this was the case in both high availability and disaster recovery scenario. So it cost them a lot of money to get that thing into place first. And it took 3 months even before we could start building out a SharePoint project. So it's not but money only, it's timing as well. And then they need to buy or hire new people to run that virtualization rig as well. So you have to think about a lot of things. You cannot have it all at once. If you have an easy management of the solution and high performance, it's going to cost you more money. You have to cut somewhere, unless you have unlimited amount of money, but I haven't met that customer yet. So this is really important. This is the one people are not longing for, but this is really interesting. What size do I have on my computers or servers? How many cores, how much RAM, etc. And you can read it on TechNet. They have the minimal and recommended, etc. But that's a general guideline. You have to test everything, see how it works in your solution, especially if you're doing custom development on top of this. Because those recommendations on TechNet, they are for the vanilla SharePoint. Nothing added to it. Very simple. And the customizations tend to increase the hardware resources. But basically, the baseline is it's the same as for 2010. Same type of service, but you need more of them. A lot more of them. You need more memory on them. You need more disk. But CPU-wise, it's basically the same, but you need to scale it out a bit, or a lot. Think of physical and virtual machines. Everybody wants to virtualize stuff nowadays, but if you have a machine that's going to have 96 gig of RAM, it's sometimes even cheaper to have it physical. So in one of my cases now, we have a combination of it. The beefy servers are physical, and the application servers and web servers are virtual, and the SQL boxes are physical as well. And this is also really important, fault domains. We talked about it in Neil's session yesterday. It's really important to have redundancy in it. So don't buy the beefy server. Instead, buy two less beefy servers, or three. Because here are my two key numbers when I design a farm. 3 is a new 2. And 7 is a new 5. The first one, 3, is a new 2. We always think of we need 2 web servers, 2 application servers, 2 SQL servers. If everything is good, that's perfect. One can go down and the other one takes the load. But what happens in the scenario when we are patching one machine and the other one goes down? Then we have nothing. So basically, to have good high availability, we need 3 of them. So we can take one down for maintenance, one can crash, and one can still handle the load. With reduced performance. And 7 is new, 5 is basically we need 3 front ends, 3 is the new 2, 2 servers in the, or 3 servers in the application layers, and 2 servers, a SQL. So it's 7 servers, a minimal farm actually, to get this working properly, in my opinion. Not all my customers are running 7, some of them have fewer, some of them have more. But it's a good recommendation to start with for a medium or small business, because then they have high availability, they can patch the machines, etc., without risking too much. So that's a good starting point. And now we come into the discussion on where do I put my query server, where do I put my service applications, etc. And it's been pretty consistent over the last few years. We're talking about web front ends, application servers, and SQL servers. That has changed somewhat in 2013. It's not the actual product that has changed it. It's more like we have experience and know how it runs better. And a lot of that experience comes from the Office 365 team and how they run their services. Because finally, Microsoft has a good testing bed for SharePoint. They actually test it all the time. So which is really good. So many of the recommendations I'm saying here and that are on TechNet comes from the Office 365 team. So planning out the topology. And the topology is where do we put our servers, where do I put the service applications and services. And first of all, there is no farm to rule them all. You can't download this architecture diagram from TechNet and say, this is what you're going to use, and this is what we're going to use. Every customer is unique depending on their workloads or their demands and needs. And it's a very iterative approach. And even after you have gone into production, you have to revisit this one and monitor all the time. Use some monitoring software such as SCOM or whatever to see how it's working. Do we need that many servers? Sometimes we can even reduce the number of servers. And reducing the number of servers can actually improve performance. So this is something that you need to take into consideration, especially planning it out. Then your development team starts to build stuff. You have to constantly test this. Does our initial design fit, or do we need to revisit them? And it, as I said previously, it's not only about the nice visual diagram. You have to think about hardware and virtual hardware, different components, services and people. And it's not about SharePoint services, SQL boxes. You have to think about Active Directory as well, workflow manager forms, Office Web Apps forms. It's a lot of thinking around it. And I'm going to show you one example later when we actually had two forms and that we were swinging back and forth between to get the highest lowest possible downtime. This is don't take this as the way to do it. This is how you should think of it, instead of in terms of layers and where to put things, and the different type of layers and different type of services. I divide it into five different layers. We have the routing and caching layer, and the difference between them are the latency. How long does it take a process? Should it take to process a request? This is not network latency. This is how long a request or operation should take. So the routing and caching and database layers, and any operation should be less than 5 milliseconds on those. We have the web app layer and the search layer. It's about half a second. And the operations on these, it might vary, but this is a good starting point. Then we have something called the batch processing layer. That's stuff that takes long time to run. For example, workflow, as we will see soon. So what do I place in my routing and caching layer? The layer might be a set of servers, three for instance. And here's a very good to place the request manager and the distributed cache. I.e., you have servers that handles the request and passes them to other servers. I have not in a single case yet implemented a separate routing and caching layer. I merged that with the layer below it, because this is most often too expensive having three extra servers just for distributed cache. There's some guidance on Technet to some people that claims that this is the best way to do it. Yeah, it might be. You have to test it. It all depends on your customer and their needs. Then we have the web application and application layer. There we have basically web application and all the light service applications such as MMS, BDC, Secure Store, User Code Access, etc. We place these together. This is what we usually put in one web front layer and one application server layer, but basically these two fit very nice together. And the new application layer, so to say, is where we place search. The search stuff, such as query, admin, or index, those more, we say, lightweight search parts. The more heavy search parts are placed in the batch processing layer. And then we have search processing crawl. You don't have 500 millisecond response time on the crawl or the analytics. They take a lot of time and a lot of resources. And then, of course, we have the SQL layer. So this is how I start to think about how to build out my topology. And some layers are merged, but normally it goes like these three top ones are my previous front ends. Those are the ones that are facing the clients. Then I have a separate search index, basically. And of course, you use the profile synchronization service can run there. Machine translation, those long-running stuff, workflow. If you now decide to use a workflow manager in your SharePoint farm, this might be an appropriate target for that one, unless you run it on dedicated servers. Make sense? Make sense? Yeah, good. So you can scale it up by having new layers. And you can scale it out, of course, having more servers. But this is a good starting point. Let's take a look at search specifically. I mentioned it a couple of times here. It requires very different planning compared to 2010. First of all, we have a whole new set of components. It's split up into more pieces or services. You all seen the NodeRunner.exe process running, consuming a lot of RAM. And it's not only for search stuff, the search service application. It's used for cross-site publishing, as we've seen yesterday. All the analytics are in the search nowadays. It's used for recommendations and all kind of stuff. And it's an essential part of any SharePoint farm. And we have a new set of roles. We have the administration role, the crawler role, the content analytics processing, and index and query processing. Neil's going to go into every detail of this in a few hours. But this is really important, how to put these different roles on different servers, because they consume especially a lot of RAM, and some of them consume a lot of CPU, and some of them consume a lot of disk. Here's an example from one server, one of my customer servers. You see we have three node runners running here. It's quite a lot of memory consumed by those three processes. So these are most likely your beefy machines, the search machines. And here's the slide that I borrowed from Neil. I guess you're going to show it later as well. Yeah. But this is also, I use this for every new deployment, how to combine my different search roles. You can see here how much resources different things use. For instance, the administration component is very lightweight, whereas the content processing and an index it requires much CPU and also memory. And the crawler and the analytics requires much network. So find a good combination of these, unless you're going to have 6 times 3 servers. So here's a good recommendation, also made by Neil, how to combine these. Use the content processing, analytics processing. That's a good target for one machine. In the batch processing layer, these are things that run in the background and building up your index and metadata and everything. Admin and crawl can go nice together. Admin is very lightweight. Crawl is a beast, especially if you're using continuous crawl. In one of my customers, we have continuous crawl every 3rd minute. And when it's hitting the front ends, the web application service, there are 3 of them. So every 3rd minute, basically for 20 seconds, it's 100% CPU, because the crawl role is so aggressive, just fetching everything it can, because it just fetches the data and passes it to the content processing, analytics processing. So it might be a good idea to, for instance, use request management to set up a crawl target or separate service for handling the crawl load. It was in the previous slide here as well. Let's go back. I put the crawl target down here. That's a server running the web application and your solution that actually takes a load from the crawler. So let's get back here. And index and query, yeah, of course, they're really good to put together because the query uses the index, etc. So we don't have to go over the network there. And in many cases, I even these 4 together and these 2 together are appropriate. So that one was the native SharePoint search services and search applications, etc. And what's the time? Yeah, we're good. Let's take a look at workflow and Office web apps. Workflow, basically we have 2 workflows in 2013. We have the old 2010 style workflow that you should not use, because the new workflow in 2013 using Workflow Manager is far better. But it requires very different planning, especially with regard to business continuity management. If we have time, I have a story about that later. And Office web apps is no longer a service application. I'll be coming to that. So it also requires some planning. But Workflow Manager, the important thing here is you only have 1 or 3 servers to install it on. It cannot be installed on 2 or 4. It's 1 or 3 servers. So basically, in all the implementations, you're going to have 3 servers, either dedicated or shared with other things for Workflow Manager. Workflow Managers can share service with SharePoint, but it all depends on your implementation. Are your customer using a lot of workflows, or aren't they? In my opinion, the Workflow Manager is kind of lightweight, actually, because all it does is orchestrates the workflow, and it sends out web service or REST requests to other services. So it's basically just sending, and it's not doing that much calculations. But it all depends. You have to evaluate your needs or your customer's needs. Office web apps, it cannot share service with anything. You cannot put that on a set of SharePoint boxes or SQL boxes. It has to be on its own dedicated servers. And it's actually my favorite product. I have a whole session about it tomorrow. Come to that if you like. And this is, as a side note, that is how a server product should be built. unlike SharePoint. So this is required. You need at least two servers for that one, or three, if you follow my three is a new two. But in that case, I normally do an exception. Two is, for Office Web apps, normal enough. The customer don't cry that long if they don't have access to the Office Web apps for an hour or two when they need. I'm going to go through this really quick. This is what I stumbled upon when starting our first 2013 deployments. Since there are so many services, and there are especially search, distributed cache, etc., using so many different ports and everything, and I was with the customer that had very strict rules, even between our different layers almost. So we had to open a lot of ports on different places, etc. So think about this, because this took a lot of time for us to get into our minds, first of all, finding all the ports. Secondly, get their firewall and ops team to implement this. Okay, now we looked into some topology things, some things to think about when designing the number of servers, etc. And as I said, there's no form to rule them all. It's up to you and your needs and your customers' needs, their money, their budget, their operations, and their maintenance, and their teams within their organization. Oh, sorry. So we're going to take a look at the one web application to rule them all. It's the new shiny thing in SharePoint 2013. This is how I built out all my farms in 2013, using one single web application for everything and using hostname site collections. And that's also how the 365 team does it, right? So instead of setting up a web application in SharePoint and listening to a specific host header, we set up a new web application without any host headers. So basically, listen to all incoming requests. And then each site collection has its own DNS or a host name or URL. So each site collection are connected to a DNS name instead. This is a new recommended guidance. It's not actually new. It's been in the product for quite some time. But now it's made some performance improvements and other stuff into it and made it somewhat more manageable. There's still no central admin stuff for it, except creating the web application. For each new site collection you're going to create, you have to use PowerShell. You should use PowerShell anyways. The good thing with this is it actually reduces memory footprint. As soon as you create the web application, and just, you don't even have to hit any page, it consumes about 400 or 500 megs of RAM for each web application, just having it there. So you save some memory for it. And especially if you have your own customizations, that's going to be loaded up into that process as well. This is one of the good things. So we use the resources in our hardware and virtualized hardware much better. And in most of the cases, to get the single web application approach to work, we need to use hostname site collections. And having a web application listening to all incoming requests is a requirement to get SharePoint apps working. So if you're not using the single web application approach and you need SharePoint apps, you're going to have at least two web applications. So as I said, if you use a single web application approach, we can use one single web application and both for apps and our custom site collections and sites. Here's an example. Here's one web application, 7.7 gig of RAM on that one, and they can consume much more. So imagine you have several web applications on your server. You need very beefy servers in that case. So hostname site collections. Some of you were aware of it, some of you not. So we're going to talk you through it a bit, and I'm going to show you a demo really quick soon. Basically, we have hostname site collections and path-based site collections. Path-based site collections is the old way we did it. We had One web application listening to host header, then we have managed paths, etc. And here's a comparison of the different two. For hostname site collections, we require PowerShell to create site collections. And path-based, we can use PowerShell or central admin. The benefit of using hostname site collections is we can use different DNS names. For instance, we can have HTTPS search, we can have Teams, collaboration, intranet, my site in the same web application. If we use path-based ones, we have to use intranet.coso / search, for instance. So it's much easier for the end user to remember the actual DNS name or when they type it in the browser, for instance. So it's a usability thing as well. But don't go too far there. I have one customer that we have like 100 top levels instead. Each department have their own DNS name. It works fine because they can run it in HR or whatever directly, but we're publishing this through UAG. And UAG is not that smart, so we have to put in all of these entries into UAG as well. So maintenance-wise, it costs us something. But it's very easy for the end users. I want to go to the HR department, just put in HR. So it has some benefits. One really important thing is we need a root site collection. And I will show that in a demo, what that is. But a root site collection is basically, in the web application, we need one site that is path-based, but it's not tied to a dedicated, to a DNS name. This web application should not be used for anything. It's used by SharePoint itself, especially for search, when search needs to find new content databases, etc. So it's a starting point for all the crawls. If you don't have any root site collection, first of all, you're not supported. Secondly of all, you won't find new sites and content databases. We can, in path-based, we can use the classic approach alternate access mapping if we need different URLs on different sites. In hostname site collections, we can use the PowerShell command, add SPSite URL, set SPSite URL, I think it is called, or remove SPSite URL. Path-based site collection, there is an out-of-the-box self-service site creation that works perfectly fine. If we want self-service site creation with hostname site collection, we have to build something our own. There's no out-of-the-box feature for that. In path-based site collections, the managed paths are determined by the web application. For hosting site collection, it's a farm-level setting. We'll also show you that. The thing that I hear the most is when using hosting site collection is that we have one single web application, and that web application has a set of content databases. So when we create the site collection, it ends up in any of these content databases. And most often, you don't want to mix the records management databases or that stuff. You don't want to mix my sites and team sites in the same. They might have different SLAs. That's one of the reasons why you sometimes should use a separate web application. If you have a record management application, for instance, and wants its own set of content databases. You can actually, using hostname site collection, create a custom site creation provider where you override the default behavior of determining which content database to put a site collection in and create your own logic for that, which in many cases are good recommendation anyways. I use a custom one that not only looks at the number of site collections within a database, but the actual size of the site collections, so it finds a more appropriate partner. So I recommend that. I have a blog post on it on my blog if you want to read up on it more. There's a couple of things with hostname site collections you have to watch out for. First of all, I mentioned the root site collection. It's a support requirement. And it must have the same name as the web application. You will see that in the demo in a few minutes, that the web application we're creating having a server name. We have to use the server name of when we create a web application, which means we're depending on one specific server. This is what TechNet says. I have an approach that I'm going to show you to get around that. If you're using SSL termination, you must make sure that your load balancer or whatever terminates SSL can pass this header into SharePoint. Otherwise, it will not work. And as I said, default site creation provided can cause SLA problems. So here's this example that I prepared, that we have one web application, server one, connected to that one. It can, of course, have several servers, but the actual web application is created with a server name. Otherwise, that's the only way to do it, right? Otherwise, we put in a host name, and then we cannot use this host name site collections. And we have a root site collection without any template, which is the target that crawl uses to find new information. Then we create a site collection. We can create site collections that my.intranet, etc. And then we can also use managed path, farm level managed path for the personal sites, for instance. And I will show that in a demo here. Let's see here if it wakes up. So I already run a few of these scripts, so we don't have to see what is creating a new web application. But what I've done is actually I created a new web application. I only pass in port here and URL, this name of the server. I don't use any host header here. So this is name of the server. And I always try to use the fully qualified domain name. Do that every time. Don't use a NetBIOS name. After that, I create a new site collection here. And it also has the name of the server or the name of the web application. And notice I don't pass in a template here. So it has no template. And in this case, I also use the install account that's the owner for this one, because no user will ever go here. It's only basically the search that's going here. Then I can create a standard site. You can read this here. The site, I give it whatever name I want here. Of course, in this case, I set up a wildcard DNS entry, so everything demo.carp.local points to this machine. So I can basically put whatever I want in front of demo.carp.local here. And the key thing here is when I'm creating this site is to use host header web application that I specify which host header web application are to be used by this site collection. Then there's just some warm-up stuff there. Then I create a new managed path. I think I did that one. Let's try. Yeah, I already did it. So here's the key thing. I create the managed path, and I pass in the host header argument there. Then I create the my site with SPSM site host, also passing in host header web application. And then I configure that in the user profile as well. But here's my trick. Since I said now we're depending on that machine being available all the time, because that's where, if you take a look at search, what happened to that? Service applications, search. Take a look at the content source here. As you can see, that one now points to that specific machine. So if that machine is out of order, taken out of rotation, or decommissioned, or whatever, we're not going to have any working crawl anymore. So how do we solve that one? What I do is I create an alternate URL for that web application, basically, and call it root.demo.corp.local. So everything all requests on root.demo.corp.local goes to that web application in this case. So what I do now is just go in here, change that one here to root, spell correct, root.demo.corp.local. And now I'm no longer depending on that specific server. And I experienced this the hard way. And since if you don't do this up front, if you change the URLs in that content source, you need a full crawl. And with a couple of million documents, that full crawl takes some time. And basically deletes everything in the index. And you have to redo it. So do this as one of the first things when you set up a server. Or make it scripted, of course. So it's not that hard to set it up. And I think it's very easy, especially on a development machine. It's really easy to have different URLs and testing with. So it's perfect. I really like this approach. And the only thing is that all site collections has to be created by PowerShelling using that attribute, host header web application. And there's an ISV opportunity, create the central admin plugin for. That was a short demo. Running out of time here, I'm going to run fast. So this is one of the very important things, use certificates. It's going to cost a lot of pain and anger in the beginning, especially if the customer not used to working with certificates. But there's so much things in SharePoint now with 2013 that needs to be protected with certificates. So always use certificates. Even in some of my development machines, use certificates just to have a feel at it as a developer. For instance, apps, workflow, office web apps, etc. They're all sending stuff over the wire. And you want to have that encrypted all the way. So use certificates. It's really important. And this is one of the things, make sure your customer can handle that. In many cases, they don't have any certificate authority configured or set up or any policies or anything for that. So you might have to help them with that as well. So I'm going to talk about two real-world examples here and how we built out. The first one is a collaborative intranet for about 25,000 users. We used a lot of SharePoint Social. We used some BI features, such as Excel services, Power Pivot, Performance Point. At the moment, we have, I think a couple of weeks back, we had 3,500 documents. We're right now in the middle of a big migration, so it's going to be about 10 million documents when we're ready. And as you can see, in this case, we have 6-8 servers, SharePoint boxes, and 3 SQL servers. We're going to go through layering in a bit. A combination of virtual and physical. Our search boxes here in the back and SQL boxes are physical, whereas the 6 servers up front here are virtual. We're in the process of moving all the disks for index to SSD disks to get a performance there, and some of the SQL disks as well, because we noticed that the performance of the disks where the index is really affects the queries. And with not in the picture here, we have 2 separate servers for Office web apps. And the cool thing for me is that we actually have 2 identical farms. So we're moving back and forth between them. So we're patching one farm and put the other one in read-only and move everything over. And the users have an hour, 2 hours of read-only, and then a short glitch, and then they're over to a new patched farm. So it's basically no downtime. It's not zero downtime, but very, very low. And we need that because we have almost 24 hours, uses 24 hours a day on this one. But in this case, we put the workflow manager on the 3 servers up front. That was the reason, because we needed to load, we wanted to load balance the workflow endpoint. And we could, due to how the network is configured here, we can only do it on the 3 on the top. Initially, we had web applications and search, query, and index on the 3 servers on top here, which the end users were hitting. But during one of these swings, we changed that. So we moved the query and index to these 3 boxes and all the lightweight service applications to the one on the top here. We kept some BI, Performance Point, UPS Sync, etc. on those boxes. And we noticed a significant improvement in performance, just moving the index and query off the web application servers, because they competed about both disk and memory. So it's much better resource usage doing that. And you might wonder why we have 3 SQL servers. We're using SQL mirroring, even though we have Windows Server 2012. Because enterprise license, which is required for using Always On, was out of the question. So we had to go and use the deprecated, mirroring, but it still works. It's still supported for this version. And it worked. Their operations team knew how to handle SQL mirroring, so it was a perfect match in this case. So we couldn't use all the new cool features in 2012. But it works perfect in this case. Yeah, so this is a really good, and it's been working out really well performance-wise. The fortune we have, since we have 2 identical forms, we can actually test different configurations and compare them to each other. So basically, for each swing we do some tweaking as well and see if it works out better. The second example is a .com site. We're using all physical machines here, actually. that had to do, it was in their case cheaper to buy physical machines here. We have two layers only here. So this is a public.com site using cross-site publishing. So a lot of search. They're all physical. The first layer, web application, all service applications are running on them, and index and query. In that case, we're combining it. We have 48 gig of RAM on those. Then two search servers for content processing and analytics, and crawl and admin. They have 24 gig of RAM. And then we have SQL Server 2012 using mirroring and 96 gigs of RAM. And if you know the SQL SKUs, you know that the SQL standard can only use 64 gigs of RAM. So we're actually using two instances on that one to use the full amount of RAM instead. So there's a lot of compromises in these. They don't fit into any of these architecture diagrams on TechNet. But we have tested and iterative worked out these plans on how to work to use it, to build out this topology, and it works out quite fine. Here's some other important things. HA and DR, Neil talked about it yesterday, and that's really important to do in the beginning. And as I said, the 3 is a new 2. It's really good to have it, at least for the web application and service application layer. And don't forget to factor in workflow. Provider-hosted apps. We haven't talked a lot about apps, but provider-hosted app basically means you have an app that's running not in SharePoint, it's running somewhere else. So you might need an IIS farm. Now the customer I have, basically we have 3 servers, separate servers, running IIS only for provider-hosted apps. Access services is a mess for SQL admins since they're going to create a whole lot of new access services databases. So you have to make sure that those are in your backup and restore schema, etc. And what Neil also talked about yesterday, you want a cold, warm, hot standby, with hot being the most expensive one. Yeah, it will cost. The more you have, backup restore is the cheapest one, and it's basically what we're doing when we swing in between the farms. We can basically take a backup and restore on the other farm, but we do it in a kind of smart way. And this is my favorite slide. And too often we see people use things that they shouldn't use. First of all, multi-tenancy. How many of you are using multi-tenancy in here? Nobody dares to put up their hand now. There's some. Multi-tenancy is in 99% of the cases I see used for the wrong reasons. Some people used in 2010 to get it work around the enterprise standard licensing stuff. A whole lot of reasons. But basically, multi-tenancy is built for large hosters to have. And just using multi-tenancy improves complexity a lot. And you lose some features as well. So think carefully when using multi-tenancy. Geo-distributed topologies, you cannot replicate SharePoint. There are some products that do it quite well, but you cannot normally replicate SharePoint. And especially if you have servers in Europe or Australia and China, for instance, we can use service application federation in some cases for some service applications. In the first example with the collaborative internet there, we have one server, these two farms in Europe and one in China, and we're actually using MMS service application federation to have the metadata intact. We don't federate anything else. We have separate UPS instances, do not use UPRE, separate search, etc. It improves complexity a lot and it put a lot of requirements. Yes? The only thing you cannot federate with 365. Good question. The only thing you can connect basically with the Office 365 is search, create a hybrid search. So you have, you can't search in both on-prem and 365 at the same time. But you cannot federate service applications. That's a shame. Yeah, I agree. It would be really cool if that worked. Service farms is one of these cool things you can do, also done most often done for the wrong reasons. In some cases, it might be necessary to have a dedicated search farm, and that's in those cases when you have hundreds of millions of documents, for instance, like in 365. But putting up a separate service farm makes it really very much more complex. So, how are we time? Almost. We've gone through a couple of things here that I hope you agree with me, that you actually don't take the architecture diagrams and apply to customers. You have to think it through, think of a lot of things, not only the actual servers, the operations team, the budget, etc. And things will change. And be prepared to change your decisions as well. And of course, base your design on experience. That's the best thing to do, and see what happens as a customer. Don't be afraid of asking the customer a year later. Go back and ask how and talk to the operations team. Look at the performance counts, etc. A year later, see how it's working. And don't believe everything you read, as I said before. There's a lot of false information out there, and be sober and take a sober decision on your needs. So that's basically what I had to say. We have a couple of minutes for questions, and we have some cool swag over here. So hands up for any questions. We have one down there. No, extranets and single web applications. No, I don't see any special needs for that. And it depends on how you publish it on the extranet. If you're using a reverse proxy, for instance, you can just publish those DNS names, etc. One benefit you have with multiple web applications is you have process isolation. So then it's a security decision you have to take. Do we need to isolate the extranet from the internet, for instance? So that's a good question. You get one of these for that. Let's see if it works, yeah. Here you go.
I've already got one of these.
You got, then you get the other package here. So, we had one question over here. Yeah?
What are you using creating a new web farm on the Azure hosting
platform? What? Creating on Azure, yeah?
Yeah, it seems to me that it may be a better solution to go straight to that, because I can add service, get rid of service.
Yeah, that's a really good way, and hoping for more information on, with Neil's help later on this year, on how to get that to work properly, etc. Personally, when I did that half a year ago or something, there were some issues with infrastructure as a service with regards to disk latency for search, for instance. But that's continuously improved, and I know it's better now. So that's a really good option to do. Use Windows Azure Active Directory and connect to your on-prem with VPN and have the service in the cloud instead. Yeah. So I expect there to come out a lot of white papers on that in the coming future. Yeah. It's a good option even for, as I said, you have to test this. Use Azure IaaS as a testing platform and performance test that one with your solution, because you can easily scale out to 20 servers. It costs you some money, but you don't have to buy that hardware and put it up in your own virtualization rig. We had a question down there.
Just in terms of licensing the Office 365, is there any sort of additional licensing for that?
No, I'm going to talk about a bit tomorrow, but basically installing Office Web Apps is free. It's free for external users, and internal users still needs an Office Professional Pro Plus license for editing. What? Yeah. So, yeah, down there.
You mentioned that the topology can change over time. So have you got any comments on the complexity of monitoring a SharePoint environment? Because you obviously want to be proactive about that kind of stuff. What advice have you got for monitoring a SharePoint?
There's a lot of things. We saw Mark's session yesterday. Using the built-in features, for instance, and then using some systems like SCOM or whatever, take a look at RAM and disk, etc. And what's really good with SharePoint is you can, even through central admin, really easy turn on and off a service application instance. So you can just switch the MMS from your application tier to web server tier in just a minute and see if it works out better during a... the first thing I would do is use Task Manager. See how much memory the different process using. That's a really good way to start and see if, or perform normal performance monitor. There's, I think it's a good article on TechNet. I don't have the URL in my head, but which performance counter you should look on. You should constantly monitor a farm, of course. Yeah.
Itself, but are there some sort of basic things that, like tricks that you use, like just multi upload, like a bulk load of information, or is there any particular tests that you use as your sort of benchmark?
Yeah, I use Visual Studio to load test and doing long running tests with. And then basically each customer has their own scenarios that we test. So it's very depending, and especially if you're doing customization on top of that. So it's very different. So that's what we use. That's something you also, it's really important, don't do it the last week before production. That's something that must be done continuously. And it takes some time to set it up, but once you've done it and set it up, it's really great having there and get that metrics and put it down and talk to customers and see, okay, now you enable these features. For instance, if you use a lot of social features, you're going to see the distributed cache and using more memory, etc. And eventually going to hit that, we need a separate set of boxes for these ones. That's a good question. That's worth this magic spider. Because I love Visual Studio Test. Any more questions? Or do I need to end? I need to end. So thank you very much for having me here. There's a lot of more interesting sessions today going on and tomorrow as well. And I'll be in this room all day, so if you have any more questions, please come up to me. Thanks.